into the world, shiny broken pearls. Can't deny you, this was always true. First a land of gold, blackened by the cold, filtered to a brew, this was always true. Broken by the test, coming home to rest, I could lay with you. This was always true. 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 Step into the world, shiny broken bird. Can't deny you, this was always true. First a land of gold, blackened by the cold. Filtered to a brew, this was always true. Broken by the dead, coming home to rest, I could lay with you. This was always true. 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 This was always true.
Welcome to the Truth to Power Show on Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm your host, VJR Nathan, and with us today is Gaurav Venkateshwar. We just listened to Always True, one of his songs. Raised in Chicago and based out of New York, Gaurav finds inspiration from his South Asian heritage as well as music genres around the world. Gaurav has studied Indian and Western classical music, along with music composition, jazz, and electroacoustic music. Gaurav is also the founding member of Chi-Town, a collegiate Indian American a cappella group from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign that specializes in mixing South Asian and Western music. Welcome, Gaurav.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. So why don't we start off like dovetailing our last guest 2 weeks ago. We talked a lot about storytelling and the power of stories in our society. Why don't we start off by talking about your connection with storytelling and music and how the you are able to bring that space into music. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. So I think arts in general are inherently about telling stories, as is music. I think my music, coming from me as an Indian American, inherently tells a story of being an Indian American immigrant, inherently tells the stories of my background, having studied Indian classical music, how I try to bring that into my music, and how I try to fuse that in into kind of, as you just heard, kind of a pop sound or a Western sounding genre. And that inherently is a way of telling stories. That specific song that we heard was me telling a story of being in New York. I'm from Chicago, a big metropolis, but New York is an even bigger metropolis. I've been here for about 8 years now, but when I first came here for many years, it was just such a grind in such a way. I also was doing business school part-time and working full-time. So it's quite a grind, but it's a city that was pretty intense. And I think now I'm finally finding my feet here.
Great.
But I think that the story in that piece was just around stepping into this world, which is really shiny in New York, but there's also this like grit and the grind that you go through every day. But I always had someone home to come home to. I'm happily married, and just kind of thinking about having a even if you're not married, just to have like a safe space to come home to, and a place of comfort to find your center and your own truth.
Yeah, and also the in regards to stories, the power of mythology and the power of our cultural heritage is often told through stories and communicated through stories, and how we find that deep truth in those stories and connect with something that is eternal or universal and such. If you could talk a little bit about kind of how you bring in maybe the cultural heritage as well into your music or into your life.
I mean, you know, I think Indian music is very rich. It's so, you know, we have roots going back over 2,000 years. You can go back and see the heritage. And, you know, our mythology is rich. You know, it's actually descended from Indo-European mythology. So you have cognates Indian mythology has cognates in Greek and Germanic mythology and all that stuff. So we're really ancient if you think about, and we're just continuing that tradition. Musically speaking, again, I've learned Indian classical music. While it's very distinct from Western classical music, there are entry points in which music can be fused together. It's very melodic. And with Western music, there's a lot of harmony. I think the strength of Western music is in its harmonies and its ability to have chords and layer that on top of a melody. And then I think within Indian music, there's so much intricate melody that can be brought in and fused in together. So when you mix the two, it creates something beautiful that's from both sides, I would say.
Yeah, I understand. If we could talk a little bit about kind of a little bit more in depth about the systems and how they're different and how they and you're able to mix them, because people that may not realize that Indian music has like I'm only vaguely familiar with like ragas and all these different ways in which Indian music is organized that is vastly different from Western music, but you're able to find points of contact. You know, in the Wikipedia article for ragas, it says there's no Western equivalent. But we were talking, as a musician, you're able to find those points of contact that
I'm
able to, if you talk a little bit about that, yeah.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, Indian classical music is as you said, based on ragas. What is a raga? A raga is basically a scale, so a set of notes. So, like, in Western music, you learn, like, if you learn piano, you're just going to learn to play in middle C, and you'll learn, if you play a simple scale, it'll be the major scale. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. That's kind of the major scale, but then you have minor scales, so that's a minor scale, and then you can have all sorts of permutations. So a raga is a scale in that sense. So we have, you know, different permutations of you have 12 chromatic notes in a scale, but you can have different permutations of which notes you're going to use within a raga. And so when you're singing a specific piece that's based on a raga, you're using only the notes of that scale. But it also goes a step further because there's more color added to. You can have multiple ragas that use the same notes, but they sound completely different because the combinations of notes you would use within that raga would make it sound different and have bring about different kinds of aesthetic nuances. And so. You know, just by the fact that I was able to explain, I was just saying the scale kind of without, you know, I was just saying the scale out. Those scales you can have in Western music, there are modes, there's such a thing as modal music. And you can hear that a lot of times in medieval music. It's very, very obvious. But I often explain ragas in terms of what's the closest mode in Western music. It's not perfect. But then once you have that, you know, at the end of the day, ragas are made of notes and chords are made up of notes. And if you can find the right chords to go with a certain notes in a raga, You know, that's where you can find ways to bring in the harmony that Western music has to offer. I often, when I hear Indian music, I feel like inherently you can hear chords, because even though it's very melodic, you know, notes, I mean, not getting too geeky about theory, but like, you know, notes, you want to resolve tension between notes when you're doing music. And that's part of the joy of music, is hearing notes resolve or not being resolved. And that's very present and obvious in Western music, but you can hear that definitely in Indian music as well.
Yeah, and I understand, with having listened to you perform, I understand you use like electronic, you use some kind of synthesizer. How do you actually do this? Talk a little bit about kind of when you're actually performing, what instruments you use, and how you are able to, you know, blend these. It seems it's very complex from a layperson's perspective.
Right.
But like,
yeah.
How you're able to do
that. Yeah, I mean, my joy is producing music and like composing and recording. So when I perform, sometimes I can just, you know, I have a keyboard where I can just play the like, piano or whatever sound and just play as if I'm playing a piano, which is pretty simple. But when I have more complex music, like the one we just heard, that is pre-recorded. But I use my computer, like Logic Studio, which is one of the softwares available on the Mac. I use that to really, as my canvas, to put, I can lay down one track for beats, one track for chords, and one track for bass, and like multiple layers of basses and chords, and record my voice and then process that with multiple effects. I think people sometimes, there's probably some people that like more natural sounding things. I just view the voice as another instrument. Technology is another instrument.
Yeah.
How can you process that and make it sound interesting, and not just process, but interesting as well?
Yeah, I think the effect is very powerful and emotionally resonant. And we'll be talking a little bit more about, now we can move into like, that was just a checklist for our music geeks out there to understand a little bit of the complexities and the systems involved with, you know, mixing East and Western music is not as simple as it seems. You know, it requires a lot of skill, it requires a lot of navigation, especially producing the kind of sound that you're producing. It's not just a question of hodgepodge. You know, it's a very analytic system.
If you want to make it sound authentic or different, definitely.
And we were talking a little bit about kind of the stories of Vedantic traditions, Ramayana, the Mahabharata, the two major epics.
Yeah.
That we both learned through Amartya Katha,
definitely,
which is the comic book, the Indian comic book that makes a lot of these esoteric texts like Puranas very accessible.
Yep.
All these stories that people, scholars may read through the Puranas, we learn through comic book form.
Definitely.
So if you talk a little bit about kind of how your exposure to Indian mythology and how your commentary and your, as an adult, you're able to.
I think growing up, growing up here, I remember my. The first time I saw this comic book was in our Hindu temple in Chicago, Lamont. It was the first kind of traditional Hindu temple built out there, at least that I knew of. And I saw a comic book around Ganesha, the elephant god who we pray to in Hinduism as the remover of obstacles, and every kind of religious thing starts with him. And I already knew about Ganesha as a god, but I don't think I knew the story till I read this comic book. And then I just fell in love with it. I have a huge collection. It's at my parents' house back in Chicago. But I just dove into it. And I think part of it's the medium. And we talked about storytelling. And, you know, I wasn't much of like a book reader, but I loved reading these comics. And I think now as an adult, I can be like, that's fine. That's another way of reading stories. But maybe back then I used to feel like, oh, I should be reading books.
Yeah.
But anyways, like the medium was amazing to get me exposed to these epics, Ramayana, various versions. There's also like lots of stories that the Ramayana has been written by different authors throughout history. So there's like, sometimes there's Amartya Katha volumes focused on a specific story that you don't get in one version, but you get another version. I learned a lot about history. And so it really drew me into this world of like, you know, Indian superheroes, if you will. And I was very into understanding like all aspects of my mythology. And as I've grown up, grown older, you know, I can look back and realize, you know, there's a rich history, rich culture, but there's also some backwards ideas that need to be updated. I think most recently, you know, I dabble in art as well. And so I thought about the story of the Ramayana. There's so again, Ramayana is about this prince Rama, who's the god that we worship in Hinduism. Rama and his consort Sita, so his wife, they're kind of worshipped as a couple, divine couple. The cliff notes is Rama and Sita were exiled from their kingdom for 14 years. During that time, Sita was actually kidnapped by a demon, Ravana, and then Rama had to go find her and made friends with these monkeys and other animals, found her in the kingdom that she was kidnapped to, that the demon Ravana lived in Lanka, now the island of Sri Lanka, according to our mythology. Mm. And then he vanquished the king, Ravana, the demon, and then brought her back home. And that's the epic in a very condensed form. It's actually really big, not only in South Asia, but in Southeast Asia. It's in Indonesia, Malaysia. It's been celebrated for centuries. One of the things that happens when in traditional mythology, when Rama rescues Sita, she's endured this ordeal of being kidnapped, forced against her will in someone else, another man's house. Instead of just receiving her and just like everything's happily ever after, let's go home. He rescues her, but it's like, I can't return home with you because you've stayed in another man's house. How do I know that you're pure? And so she has to prove her purity by walking through a pit of fire, and she walks through it unscathed, and that proves her purity. And then they go home happily ever after, so to speak. But we, you know, that's the legend. But why does that have to be the legend? It's clearly a one-sided. It's clearly very patriarchal in its notion that a woman, first of all, like the woman is questioned. And I think in today's culture, where if a woman undergoes any kind of assault, we still have this tragedy where women are questioned, or what we just went through it, in the American politics. Like, I think the last couple of months, we really were exposed to it a lot. Women are questioned, not believed. So they have to prove themselves, and it's an uphill battle. So why did Sita have to go through that? You know, when we're worshiping this god who's supposed to represent everything good, and frankly, we're worshiping her as a goddess too, and she shouldn't have had to do that. And so I drew this panel of where Sita is kind of standing, floating in the air like a radiant goddess, and Rama is bowing down to her because he realized. This is my own interpretation of making up my own mythology. He realized that he was wrong in making her endure this, and he is bowing down to her and apologizing to her. And I think in that, and he's not like a coward, or he's not like meek. He's in strength apologizing, and I think that's a great message to send to men. You know, young men is like, there's nothing wrong with admitting your faults, and there's actually. In the movie Black Panther, there's a similar scene where like a man is bowing down to a woman in a very similar way, accepting that he's wrong. So I think that's cool that I just saw that as well. But you know, just the idea that you can be, and he's a god, so he's divine, and admitting his faults, and that's a great, I think, way to update the story where that he made her go through something. He had a wrong notion. He was flawed in that notion. And she's redeemed, and she shouldn't have to go through that. And women should, the next generation of Indian women, Indian American, wherever you're from, should not have to feel like you have to prove yourself or, defend yourself that way. You should just, you should be able to not have to put up with that.
Yeah, and I think that it's important that when we talk about these so-called sacred spaces, what we think of as sacred space, and I'm putting that under kind of a question. Because, we think of sacred spaces and we think about religions and we think about these things, have to be interpreted in a certain way, very rigid.
Right.
A lot of times we associate with the idea of sacredness. But as devotees or as followers or as people who have come out of these traditions, it's so important for us to be in dialogue with that tradition.
Definitely.
And what I'm hearing from you is that, we're kind of taking those symbols, taking those places of sacredness, and we're kind of making it our own. We're kind of in communication, dialogue with it, so that then we can produce art that is in, that kind of responds to and interrogates the underlying assumptions
yep.
behind those stories.
Yeah, and I don't think this is even new. I think this has been going on for centuries and millennia.
Yeah.
It's easy for us as immigrants. I think, especially when you're an immigrant, you're holding on to the culture that you just left, and your parents are holding on to that. And then they try to, you know, they come from India where they're surrounded by it, and then they come to this foreign land where it's like very sparse, and then they want to hold on to it. And anecdotally, I've always heard people when they go back to India, or people go back to India, that it's almost sometimes like we as Indian Americans are more like traditional or like exposed to a lot more traditional culture, because in India it's evolving and constantly changing, versus we're kind of holding on to a snapshot from the 60s or 70s maybe.
Exactly. I've noticed that as well, that so a lot of times our generation is becoming more devout than even people in India, you know? But also the problematics of kind of like when we go to, at least in my own experience, I think we had a resonance with that growing up, when I would go to the Hindu temple, a lot of the priests weren't equipped to, they just knew the ritual.
Exactly.
They were able to conduct the ritual, but they weren't necessarily able to articulate or explain, well, what is this? Where is this coming from? What is the philosophy? What is the, we're very much exposed to the bhakti tradition, the devotional tradition,
right,
but very little to the yonic or the intellectual, the philosophical tradition.
Right.
So if you talk a little bit about kind of your exposure to bhakti and how you're able to bring in that philosophical ideas and all this kind of stuff. Yeah.
I think I grew up in a household, half North Indian, half South Indian, which maybe we'll get into later.
Yeah.
But my dad's side is South Indian and Brahmin. And so like I grew up learning my religion through the lens of South Indian Brahmin culture, which is known to kind of be the keeper of a lot of the traditions and the rituals. So I started with that. And then I think as I got older, started learning more about the different philosophies. We learn in the Gita about the different, there's bhakti, and there's I'm blanking on right now, but you know, there's different ways of worship, right? So bhakti is the way of devoting yourself to God, kind of on a personal level, which I found as I grew older and started learning about other religions, a very common thread. So I feel like there's a very when you think about Christianity and it's about your personal relationship with God, through Christ as a savior. Similarly, people worship, you know, if you're a devotee of Krishna, like Krishna is your savior, and you're you know, there's a lot of worship around having that personal relationship with Krishna, whether he's your friend, or there's Krishna as like the baby Krishna, which is similar to like Madonna and Jesus, baby Jesus. Yeah. And but having that like a personal bond with, rather than like a very impersonal God that's maybe more intellectual, which you can also worship in Hinduism that way as well. But I think
I think the two work together. Like wisdom has to come into play, that we're able to, you know, you're not just doing, I in my own personal belief, I think that, you know, applying this idea of blind faith,
right,
which I think has its function in specific circumstances. Mm-hmm. You know, there are times when we're in the moment and we can't be working things out in our head.
Right.
But there are times and places for us to sit down and really negotiate with our intellect and really think about what is my experience. And, you know, there's time and place for everything, in other words, you know. And I think definitely, you know, people underestimate, you know, the value of blind faith, but also they overestimate too at times. You know, I know
for
it's
sure,
this question,
for sure.
Finding that right note, you know.
Exactly, exactly. I think the beauty of maybe of Indian culture, like Hindu culture, like the pan South Asian, the religions of the subcontinent, is that there's different ways to worship. Like, you know, in Hinduism, they outline different ways you can worship. So if you're someone that is more heart driven, you can be more of a devotional. If you're a little more intellectually driven, you can achieve kind of this the oneness with God or the divine power, the divine, you know, whatever you believe in. You can achieve that through whatever way best suits you. For me, I think I found I think getting back to the topic of growing up here, I feel like I was exposed to obviously the rituals, but even sometimes the philosophy became really esoteric and much more around
like ungrounded.
Reincarnation. Yeah. You talk about your duty, dharma, and karma, kind of concepts.
Yeah.
But how does that impact you in your like relationship with your friends at school or your relationship with a spouse or things like that? And I think I found as I started exposing myself to other traditions, Buddhism. First and foremost, that was kind of the first way I branched out, not leaving Hinduism, but just like kind of opening myself up to other things in Buddhism. There's often a lot of Western teachers that have learned, gone to like Southeast Asia and learned, and they come back here and they're able to teach it to an American audience. And I think I realized, yes, I'm Indian, but I'm also American and I have a very specific cultural upbringing by growing up in this country. So while I can understand certain things, from an Indian perspective, an immigrant, like an Indian, someone from India can explain something, I can understand it. If someone's able to speak to me as an American, I can actually understand it a little bit more personally. So I think there are a lot of these teachers that would listen to podcasts and like learn about, Buddhist thought. And then I got really into reading Sufi poetry. So Rumi, that's kind of my exposure to Islam.
The mystical tradition.
Yeah, mystical tradition, really rich actually in South Asia as well. Mm. But I think that the poetry of Sufism, at least Rumi's poetry, really reminded me of that Bhakti tradition where it's all about the ecstasy of the relationship with God. The way he writes about his experience with God is it can be like a lover, like a friend, again, like all these different ways. And then later on, I also, through friends, got exposed to Christianity and learned, learned about the Bible and how to read different books. And even there are a lot of things that really, the way the Book of Psalms, in the Old Testament, a lot of the poetry there, to me, reminded me of the Sufi poetry, also reminded me of Bhakti poetry. And I just found these synergies. And again, I would listen to sermons where like, I think that a lot of them would be everyday, they would somehow be more applicable to my life. And it's just the message, I think I would love to see someone do that in Hinduism where it's not just focused, where we're able to really apply, and maybe it's there, but I just never grew up with that kind of exposure or that kind of talk available where someone could, guide me on maybe like, if you guide me on a modern, how should I engage a relationship with my girlfriend or my spouse, right? Like, I think, There are a lot of Christian sermons that talk about what that looks like. Where can we find a Hindu sermon to talk about that? I think because it is a big part of our experience, but I think a lot of times Hinduism won't, that the spiritual stuff only talks about attaining
moksha
or like detachment, and freeing yourself from the cycle of birth and cycle of death and rebirth. But we don't talk about, how can we get it more into like what it means to have meaningful relationships in the world, being a meaningful contributor to this world. And I think there's different ways you can get that message. So important,
essential to be able to conduct our daily lives, be in touch and mindful and be in a community. So the community is something I think came up in some of our pre-interview questions. About how kind of like whether we do things for ourselves, when we do things for others, and connecting with that spiritual community, and having the kind of the tensions between, and we were discussing in what you were saying is kind of touching in on what it calls tribalism, and kind of like this idea of that people feel like rigid about, oh, I'm Christian, I should only read Christian texts, or I'm Buddhist, I should only read Buddhist texts, etc., and that. Having a dialogue with the communities, inter-community dialogue, is really the main foundation for, I think, your work and all of our work,
Yeah,
go ahead and talk a little bit more about kind of how you're able to bring also that modern sensibility. We think of this as modern, but also a more compassionate sensibility. I think about it. In the cultural dialogue, we have the ideas of feminism always been there. And
yeah.
I think feminism is such an important philosophy and topic to bring up, gender equality, and we touched a little bit on that. But if you go a little bit more into kind of like, we were talking a little bit about the blog article about Radha's mistress. So yeah. Talk a little bit about that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that one, that's, I guess, also, you know, a kind of a feminist reinterpretation of music. So Radha's mistress is a piece I made. And you can find it on YouTube if you Google Radha's mistress, R-A-D-H-A, apostrophe S, Radha's mistress. So, Krishna and Radha are this divine couple, like another divine couple like Rama and Sita that I mentioned earlier, who are worshipped by Hindus everywhere. And interestingly, Radha is actually not Krishna's wife, but he's just her his lover. And it's a lot of there's a lot of poetry around this divine relationship. Specifically in North Indian classical music, a lot of the in vocal music, when you're singing a song, a lot of the poetry is around the love, this relationship, right? And so you know, I've learned many songs around Krishna and Radha and Krishna. One of them that I grew up learning has lyrics that are very typical, which is around Radha is being, you know, she's in love with Krishna and missing him or being teased by him. She's pining for him when he's away. Or in some cases she's she's trying to do her own thing and he's just kind of being naughty and teasing her and kind of getting her to, you know, it's a euphemism for, you know, kind of sexual love play in some sense. But even that is a metaphor for our love with God. It's God. So Krishna kind of teasing and prodding Radha is a metaphor for God kind of teasing and prodding us spiritually, drawing him closer drawing us closer to him or her, right? So that's what the metaphor is. So in this text, the words that are used are around Radha feeling very she's teased, maybe kind of the weaker sex. She's portrayed that way in the lyrics. She's like, what can I do? He's insisting on what exactly, right? And, you know, the words, I looked up the traditional Hindi poetry, which is different from spoken Hindi now. And I didn't grow up in India, so I didn't really study this. So like, it took me some time to do the research, but like the insisting, Krishna insisting could be also defined as him forcing himself in some way. Not exactly, but I think there are undertones of a patriarchal culture again there, where like men can kind of have their way with women, and I kind of wanted to flip that on its head, and I wanted to look at other ways that Radha's worship. I bought a book around the divine goddess and like how goddesses have been worshipped, and they talked about Radha being really worshipped as this divine equal, this kind of divine counterpart. And a worship of Radha being a deep acceptance of sexuality and female sexuality, which is now, you know, now in our culture, especially, you know, Indian culture, very taboo subject to talk about.
Yeah.
Right? So I wanted to flip that. So musically, I sang the classical piece, but I put like really heavy guitars and electronic music, and it kind of evoked a real strong passion. And then visually, I used a lot of traditional silk paintings you'll see in India of Radha and Krishna, and there's actually a lot of paintings of them in lovemaking positions. But I, you know, traditionally she will be on her back, and I wanted her to show dominance. So if you watch the video, you'll see interspersions of it where she's, I rotated the picture so she's on the top and kind of having her way and having, so she's not just a passive receiver, but she's like equally engaged in this like love in this union. And then the video ends with them kind of facing each other as equals rather than her being, again, the weaker sex.
Yeah.
And so I was trying to visually, you know, we're in a visual medium. Obviously, so part of it's portrayed by the audio that you hear, part of it's portrayed by the video. And it's not perfect because at the end of the day, there's still, I can't address everything in a 2-minute piece.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's things like Radha herself, people don't worship Radha without Krishna. People worship Krishna without Radha all the time. But she's still kind of known through him and doesn't have her own full identity and not worship that way. So there's a lot of, you know, inconsistencies. But, you know, I wanted to start somewhere and take this piece. And also, I think learning classical music, especially here, I think a lot of times in India, people don't even pay attention to the words and what they're singing. But even more when you're learning it here as an immigrant, where it's not, you're not surrounded by the culture. You are trying to soak up as much as you can, but you won't understand the lyrics fully. You don't have it. You don't, you're almost more, I find myself at least more focused on the music and less focused on the words, because the music was easier for me and the words.
Does the song Rather's Mistress?
Yeah.
Is it just instrumental or does it have?
It's got vocals.
It's got vocals?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So maybe we'll listen a little bit to that. We'll take a moment to listen to that and then we'll continue the conversation. Let's see. Wonderful, wonderful.
Thank you. Yeah, so, and you know, I didn't, one thing I forgot to mention is Radha is always portrayed as Krishna's mistress.
Mm.
And so I flipped the title calling it Radha's Mistress because it's about her taking control of this this union and not just being a passive, you know, person again. There's actually no word for, like, there's no equivalent of a mistress, a male mistress, really.
Oh, right. Like,
I couldn't find a word, but you know what we'll call it. So I remember when I posted this, some, you know, one of my uncles was like, oh, it's Radha is the mistress, not Krishna. But I was like, well, no, I'm trying to flip, flip the paradigm here.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's interesting. Yeah, I was looking that up the like 6 months ago or something. I was trying to find the word as well. I was like, wait a minute, what is the really, the, you know, it's hard to figure out what that word is. Yeah, but I don't think there is a word. But also, let's talk a little bit about, you know, North and South India, we were touching a little bit on that before.
Yeah.
And people don't realize that within India, you know, there's like, I think 23 languages.
Yeah,
and there's like
more,
a number of different sub, you know, dialects and all that. There's like 23 major, defining a language is like having, it fits the definition of a language. So 23 languages.
Yeah. Those are recognized, in fact. And there's even more that are like not officially recognized.
Oh, wow.
And stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And each area has its own culture. Going a little distance, you have like another different, wholly different interpretation and a totally different culture. And North and South is divided, I think, a little bit more than any other culture that I can think of, except maybe Italians have North and South Italian, but I don't think it's as deep a difference. Yeah.
But talk about that. I view India, you know, the South subcontinent, you know, Pakistan, India, and Bangladesh, Nepal, Sri Lanka, right? That's kind of the subcontinent.
Mm.
I view that as Europe, right? So Europe has all these different states, all these different countries, nation states, right? And really, India was that as well. And then under British rule, became one united political entity. And it's kind of remained that way, except for some of the partitions that have occurred. So it's really a complex tapestry of cultures. And so I mentioned that my mom is North Indian from Uttar Pradesh, Hindi-speaking. Hindi, many people know. My dad is Tamil-speaking from the south of India. Tamil is spoken primarily in Tamil Nadu. That he's actually from the neighboring state of Kerala, and he grew up in Calcutta, which where they speak Bengali. So again, so how I grew up with like all these different cultures. I think it's like growing up with one parent being Swedish and one parent being Greek, right?
Yeah,
it's like yes, there's this European. If you were, so if that was your background, you would have a European background, but really your two families would be very different in some ways, and in some ways they're similar. So for me, you know, Hindi is an Indo-European language, you know, so it has, it's related to English, it's related to French, German, Persian, that's a whole group of languages that it encompasses. Tamil is a completely different language. It's part of the Dravidian language, which is a language isolate family, unrelated to anything we know today. And it's those languages, the speakers of those languages are now concentrated in the south of India. So that's the first, you know, distinction right off the bat. Then culturally, you know, the kind of food we eat. So the food you have in Indian restaurants in America is primarily North Indian and primarily a specific kind of North Indian cooking that's suited for restaurants. Mm. You know, and that you'll have a little bit of South Indian. If anyone's ever had dosas, that's very traditionally South Indian. The kind of Indian crepes, but the kind of foods we eat are different. The way we worship, you know, the both will, you can be Hindu from either part of the country. But the way you would worship might be different. The gods you'd worship, the kind of rituals you do would be different. And North and South is actually very simplistic because in North India, there's different kinds. I think that divide has to do with kind of the linguistic grouping of Indo-European is kind of North and then Dravidian is kind of South, but really even within East and West and like, you know, there's a lot of diversity, you know, within that as well.
Yeah.
I think again, going back to Europe, you can think of Germanic speaking, Nordic kind of languages, and you can think of the Romance languages and, you know, maybe you can group those together, but there's a lot of differences. So I think when I, in my experience of not only growing up as an Indian American, like as one, a different culture from like maybe the majority white culture here. I also kind of think of it, I felt almost biracial in a way because of my parents being from different backgrounds. So within the Indian community, when I interacted with other Indian people that were usually of just one kind of Indian, just so to speak, I would feel like I was, you know, straddling different worlds as well.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, and even within the deity pantheon, you know, when you go to India, you know, they have specific local deities that they have little shrines to and all this kind of thing. And the diversity within Hinduism, the Sanatana Dharma, the Vedic traditions can be quite vast because they have the Vishwites, people who follow Vishnu primarily, and Shaivites, people who follow Shiva primarily, Vishnu being the god of creation and preserver, and Shiva being god of destruction, and then Brahma being the creator. So
other goddess cults as well.
Yeah, and the goddess cults, all these different, you know, Sanatana Dharma, the Hinduism, the Vedic traditions are so, it's so diverse, you know, all these different Vedas, all these different teachings. Sometimes even it feels like it's contradictory. I mean, even though I guess at some level, you know, we're able to, you know, a real scholar or someone who's able to navigate it, having that compass is able to find that trajectory which connects those seeming contradictions. But navigating the Vedic traditions can be quite difficult.
Definitely.
And especially, And just tell us a little bit more about kind of your practice and in regards to the navigating that and bringing in. Yeah.
I think when I think about that experience, I feel like it's been an exploration of belonging. Where do I belong? Right. Mm. So, you know, I grew up, because my mom is North Indian, I grew up and my dad, I grew up speaking Hindi. My dad speaks very good Hindi too. So, it was an easy, I grew up, I learned a little bit of Tamil, but that kind of faded off. I can follow maybe more than I understand, but I feel very comfortable, in a family's home where the Hindi is being spoken.
Yeah.
I also feel comfortable where Tamil is being spoken, but I always felt like I don't understand everything fully. And like, I think when I'm in a South Indian household, with my South Indian side of my family, sometimes I would feel like I'm trying to fit in, or I want to feel like I can belong more because I don't understand the language. And conversely, when I'm amongst North Indians, sometimes I felt like I wanted them to understand more about South India. Cause I think sometimes when you're from one part of the country, you don't have as much exposure to the other parts. And then I think North Indian culture has a little bit more dominance in general. We all know Bollywood, and that's part of North Indian culture.
Yeah.
And so even what people were exposed to in my experience growing up here, the North Indians had probably a narrow exposure to South Indian culture, unless you like had friends and stuff. And South Indians, as I mentioned earlier, known to really, especially the Brahmin, which is like the higher caste or the priestly caste in our culture. That's where my dad's side is from. So people in that culture are known to maintain the tradition. So I think that the view of a lot of South Indians is like the preserver of those traditions. So any kind of cultural show might open up with a classical dance from South Indian Bharatanatyam. And that would be like the only, that plus maybe someone singing a very traditional classical song would be the only representation you'd see from South India. And then everything else would be a lot more, like all like the fun stuff would be like Punjabi, like Bhangra or Garba, Gujarati, like these dances and like...
And the dance of the sticks is...
That's the Garba, Dandiya.
That's Garba, yeah.
Yeah, Dandiya, all from North India. And then a lot of Bollywood and all that. And so it's like, it almost portrays as, if you're North Indian, you might just see like the South Indian culture as being more, just traditional. And that's all they have. Or at least that's how I felt, that's not what people think. That's how I felt. And I probably felt that because I lived in both worlds and I wanted people to see more sides of South Indian music. One of my biggest musical influences of all time is A.R. Rahman, the famous Indian film composer, and he's from South India originally, and he's transformed all of he's transformed Bollywood, he's transformed just Indian music in general, and so a lot of his music, especially when in the 90s and stuff, where he'd make the same movie would be made in Tamil and Hindi, and it's the same song would be in both languages. And so I remember my first attempt at kind of navigating both worlds was like I would sing a lot of Hindi songs at Indian cultural shows, but then I started doing things where I would sing the same song, one of his songs, half of it in Hindi and half of it in Tamil, and try to bridge, like just try to show, people that there's more to South Indian culture than just the rituals and just the, and I think in that I started learning, because I think my upbringing was in a narrow view of this Brahmin family, but there's a lot of non-Brahmin.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of other aspects of South Indian, and I started singing in Tamil shows, and I sing Tamil, but I don't speak it, I don't understand it, but in that I got exposed to other aspects of what it means to be South Indian, which is great. And I think again, exploring my heritage in those two strains has been useful and helped me to see, I think, understand diversity in a different way.
And also it's important to note that each one of these systems within South and North India is like complete in and of itself.
Right.
Like they've got their thing. They've got their whole complete system from beginning to end.
Yep.
And it's not like when we dip into one aspect, and this is something I wanted to bring into in Western culture about what we think about as we start to kind of get the last 10 minutes. Western culture has been a lot of talk about cultural appropriation and kind of dipping into or sampling from these complete traditions and just taking out like, one thing. We'll take out one thing, a Kali, or we'll take out and we'll just kind of popularize it in the Temple of Doom or something and kind of completely change its meaning. And then there's a lot of criticism of that, saying that this is taken out of context. We don't want people to think that this represents,
right,
especially when there's a lack of representation in Western media.
Yep.
The only exposure people have to South Indian or subcontinent is through, their first exposure was Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. And then, it's very upsetting, but at the same time, we have to understand that this is how cultures interact.
You know,
they kind of sample, they take out something and they kind of grab something and they're
for
like,
sure,
this connects with me. But then realizing for our listeners that there's a lot more to learn and a lot more. Don't just assume.
I mean, I think historically cultures are always doing this. So, it's not a surprise like that it's happening. I think it's much more in our face because media is so mass, and there are problematic issues with representation and how, like the famous other famous example is Apu from The Simpsons.
Yeah.
You know, I love the character as a kid because it's like, oh, there's the one Indian guy on TV. He's not even voiced by an Indian person.
Yeah.
And you know, there's Harry Kondabolu, who's famous. Like, he did this documentary about Apu. I forget what's called.
Problem with Apu. Yeah,
Problem with Apu, yeah. Which was great. I saw it.
Yeah, I saw that too.
And it's great. Like, I think I grew up, I remember one kid in high school, like, his whole knowledge on Indian people was, like, based on the character. And, like, he would ask me questions which were not my experience. And I was like, no, like, yeah, like, anyway, so I think representation is important. I don't think there's anything wrong with sampling things as long as you do it respectfully and
consciously, mindfully. Yeah.
Mindfully, and you should have people, you know, have Indian people in the room. Like, we talk, like, you know, they talk about in Hollywood and on TV, like, the writer's room, and like, are there enough women in the writer's room? Are there enough, you know, African Americans in the writing room to, like, when they're trying to tell these stories, to tell all perspectives, right? So how many, if you're going to include an Indian theme, do you have the right people? Like, I one of my other pet peeves is if you're watching, like, you're watching a movie where there's, like, a South Asian person, and they say that they put the wrong language in there, or, like, the script is, like, you know, it should be an Arabic script, but they're showing, like, an Indian script, or like, these small little details, like, they just don't take the time to, and I've heard, you know, people talk about that too, but I think getting the details right. Flip side, I do feel hopeful there's a lot more, you know, South Asian representation in, like, primetime TV and movies. It's coming up with a lot of you know, well-known names. So I'm feeling positive about those kind of things changing.
Yeah, yeah. I'm listening to Patriot Act.
Yeah.
That's really great. And I think it's so important. He even had the joke about how South Asians are not just limited to doctors and lawyers. Yeah. They can be criminals too. You know,
I love that.
I love that joke because it just shows that the what is it called? The perfect ideal Asian.
The model minority
is to be undermined as well. Positive racial stereotypes are just as bad or just as crippling as negative.
It is racial actually. Stereotypes. I mean, because there are a lot of Asian American. You know, if you think about Asian American, which includes a lot of cultures, there's a lot of, you know, I think Indians and Chinese are kind of the big components of that, known to be also highly educated and, like, really driven. But there's a lot of other cultures where they're starting from a place of more poverty in this country. A lot of other subcultures that need help, but when you're looked at as a model minority, people don't think that Asians need help, but Asian Americans do need help in those spaces.
So I'll play one more song as we start to. I'll play an instrumental so we can talk over it. But do you have a call out? Would you like to play some Indian blues maybe? Or
that one's a little more noisy, but we could put it on.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so Indian blues. It's me singing the blues scale with, you know, with Indian style singing, and then with the kind of dubstep that beat. So it's got the 12-bar blues chord progression.
Good. So this is Radio Free Brooklyn, Truth to Power Show. Radio Free Brooklyn is a 501c3 nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide a free and open platform to our community and promote media literacy, education, and free expression. We rely primarily on donations from listeners like you. To help support our mission, we invite you to make a one-time donation, a monthly pledge at radiofreebrooklyn.org/donate. Every cent helps us to continue to stay on air, so please support independent community media by pledging whatever you can afford. All contributions are tax deductible to the full extent of the law. Again, that's radiofreebrooklyn.org/donate. Also, we're proud to announce that we'll be launching an after-school program for local teenagers in 2019. To learn media literacy through media making using a hands-on approach guided by local professionals. If you'd be interested in participating or donating to this program, please go to radioforbrooklyn.org/afterschool. And remember, all donations, again, are tax deductible. So great. Thanks so much. And we still have 5 more minutes.
Yeah.
What else is coming up for you? We had so many different threads, so many different things we have to talk about.
Yeah. I was going to go back to Hasan Minhaj because you mentioned him.
Yeah.
I think he, you know, big fan of his. His show Homecoming King on Netflix, when I watched it, I think what struck me the most and really helped when I talked about the sense of belonging, like, where do I belong? I saw him in his act he, obviously it's all in English, but he would not hesitate to speak in Hindi.
Yeah.
And like, and there's these beautiful visuals in the back where like he would say certain phrases in Hindi, and then like it would be written in Hindi as well. And that's the first time I'd seen like an Indian American like just fully go on. I feel like when you're an if you're being Indian American, everything would have to be in English. Mm-hmm. And you know, you just wouldn't like either you're doing things in English or you're just doing things in your language, and there's no like combining the two.
Yeah.
And so I think seeing him not hesitate to like bring his Indianness in and speak, and then he does that even in Patriot Act, he'll just like use Indian words and like he'll define it for the American audience, like what those words mean later on, but he'll just like talk in it. And that made me, you know, I think that's kind of who I am, but I never really figured out how I could embrace or combine the two. So I never used to sing in English. I would only sing in Indian languages because that's where I was trained in singing Indian style. And I didn't know how to, like, I'm not like an R&B singer. I'm not like, you know, I don't have that kind of voice, but, you know, maybe if I practice, I could try that. But I have like a distinctively Indian style of singing. But I think when I saw how he was able to fuse that, it kind of gave me this encouragement of, if he can bring in his like Indian language into his comedy act, that's in English, can I bring in my Indian style singing into an English language? And actually, so the Always Truths track that we opened up with, it's all in English, but the vocalizations are very Indian. And yeah, that was kind of, I would credit Hasan Minhaj's, like just that his act, I would credit that with inspiring me to explore that a little bit further and figuring out my place. Because the truth, I would only write songs sometimes. I would compose songs, but write in Hindi. But now, as you know, like it's not my first language, and actually now like the language is evolving with time, and I'm not like really up to date with that. So yeah, my language is English. How can I bring that, again, straddling these different worlds, bring in my my musical sensibilities with the English language? That's something I'm exploring now and hope to continue to explore.
Yeah, I was talking about like growing up, I also sang bhajans in the community, bhajans being spiritual devotional songs, and in the temples, we sing it and they have a leader. I'd be the leader. I'd sing the first line and the audience would repeat. It was a very powerful experience to be part of that community and listen to yourself singing and then having the audience
call and response
and such. And it's really great. I think that we have a little bit of that in the gospel tradition.
Yeah.
And I think that that's definitely a correlation. And that community is so important to build and develop, you know,
definitely,
to feel that power of the community, which is something, you know, sometimes is lacking, you know?
Yeah. And again, that's great. Like that call and response, known to be a very like African, in African music, is a very like a common thing, which is why you see it in gospel music with the descendants of people from West Africa. But again, that's such a powerful way of building community. And we have that in our satsang, which is like, I think we're referring to with you know, in Indian spiritual traditions, where there is a leader singing and then the group responds and sings along with it.
So where can audiences find out more about you?
Yeah, they can follow me on all the social media platforms at GVTunes. I'm most active on Instagram, but I'm on Facebook and Twitter and YouTube as well. Also, my website is www.gvtunes.com. So GV is for my initials, Gaurav Venkateshwar, so GVTunes. So that's where you can find me.
Yeah, I definitely hope people will check that out and continue listening to the Truth to Power show every Monday at 8 a.m.
Thank
Thanks so much. Thank you, guys.